this is Jill Nadeau filling in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Upper Mississippi River today with Reggie McLeod. He's the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Do you live in the Driftless area? Well, what do you call yourself? A drifter? A bluffer? A driftster? I kind of like that one. Reggie thinks you need a name, so give us a call with your ideas. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. The page title is The Larry Mueller Show. How about sharing your Driftless area photos there? Hi, Reggie. How are you today?
Good morning, Jill. Pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. I see sun, so that's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, I was surprised when I was going through the magazine, this issue coming up, which is should be in mailboxes soon, I think.
Oh, yeah.
You guys are on volume 25. Does that mean you've been there for 25 years, or the magazine's been there for 25 years?
It's a little scary. With the next issue, the November-December issue, we'll have completed 25 years of publishing.
That's amazing. How did it get started?
Well, I worked as a freelance writer in the 80s a lot, into the 90s, and I did a lot of stories about the river. I was always trying to talk editors into having me do stories about the river, and I had things in the back when there were two Milwaukee papers and then the St. Paul paper and magazines and so on. And after doing this for a while, I realized, you know, I just want to do stories about the river. So I started Big River, and of course, running a business is more running a business than doing stories, as it turns out.
Yeah.
But still, it's been a lot of fun, and those 25 years have gone by pretty fast. I'm surprised every time someone mentions that, actually.
Yeah, that's amazing. So for those who aren't familiar, why don't you tell us what they could find if they picked up an issue of your magazine?
Well, we cover the Mississippi River from the Twin Cities to the Quad Cities, and that's about 400 miles of the river. And it also kind of brackets the part of the river that flows through the Driftless area. So the Driftless area, the river, the Driftless area has a lot of high bluffs and steep high bluffs. And it's really beautiful along the river. There's a lot of overlooks, dramatic overlooks. There's a lot of islands and backwaters, and most of that stretch is national fish and wildlife refuge. So there's not only free camping, and it's pretty open to most activities, but also that's protected a lot of the backwaters from being drained and turned into agricultural land. So it's really more complex than a lot of parts of the river, too. But in doing that, we've kind of embraced the Driftless area, especially over the last few years, because those tributaries, like the Wisconsin River and the Chippewa River and the Root River, they're really part of the Mississippi River, too. I mean, you put different names on them, but when you're talking about a watershed in an area like that, it's all pretty interconnected.
And the Driftless area, we hear that a lot, but what does that actually mean? I mean, what's the area, and why is it called the Driftless Area?
Well, it was originally a geological term, and I think it's becoming more and more kind of a cultural, regional term. But Driftless refers to glacial drift, and that's the kind of gravel and eroded ground rocks that were pushed around by the glaciers. So in parts of Wisconsin, they have kettles that are scooped out of the ground and moraines, which are kind of long piles of gravel, basically,
mm-hmm.
and different features that are created by glaciers and glacial drift. Well, the glaciers during the last glacial age, the glaciers didn't cover the Driftless area, so they didn't scrape it down smoother as the rest of, you know, the area outside of the Driftless area is, and they didn't leave any glacial drift behind. So that's why it's called the Driftless area.
Okay.
Now, besides going from about Clinton, Iowa, up to the Twin Cities, it goes almost to Madison. It goes west in Minnesota, depending on the definition, probably past Rochester. It includes a lot of northwest Illinois and northeast Iowa. The biggest share of it, probably about half of it, is in Wisconsin, and the rest of it is in Minnesota, Illinois, and Iowa.
And for those who've traveled through it, you definitely know it, because there's a change, and it is so beautiful.
Oh, yeah. A lot of hills.
Yeah, a lot of hills. I don't think I'd like to bike it, but it's definitely nice to ride through
it. Oh, it's fun. It's fun to bike. I've biked it, but you usually follow the river valleys.
Okay.
I did a bike tour once following the entire length of the Wisconsin River, and that was fun. But there were a lot of big hills in there, too. But.
Okay, you have to be in good shape.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned it in your editorial, this issue, and you were talking about the Driftless area, and you're just like, we need a name for the people who live here, which I thought was a great idea. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about why you think you need a name, and what are some of the ones that you kind of like?
Well, when it was just a geological feature, we really didn't need a name because it wasn't seen as a region or a culture. But lately, especially around here, and I'm sure in a lot of areas outside of here, you see Driftless bumper stickers, you see people with Driftless t-shirts on, and there's a lot of businesses that are growing in the Driftless area that use Driftless in the name. But in thinking about that, I realized nobody's ever picked a name for the residents of the Driftless area. I mean, you have Wisconsinites and Minnesotans and Iowans and so on, but so I was kind of playing with that idea, and we had a lot of fun with it around the office. I kind of like bluffers,
yeah.
after the bluffs.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Drifters was kind of a favorite around the office, too.
Yeah, I kind of like drifters. I think that's kind of fun, kind of hip. Yeah,
yeah.
We like that. Well, we had an email from Chris in Fort Atkinson, and Chris said, growing up in southwestern Wisconsin, I developed an affection for the Driftless part of our state, the hills, bluffs, curvy roads on plowable land, lookouts, and the Ice Age Trail are only a few of the things I love about the Driftless area. What I love the most is that getting from point to point does not happen in a straight line very often.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. We're a little more circuitous around here, I suppose.
Yes, very big word. I like it.
Yeah, wow, it's nice to haul one out once in a while.
Absolutely.
I hadn't thought of that. Maybe we're not as direct as they are.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. So what's your favorite part of living in the Driftless area?
Well, the Mississippi River, actually. I mean, I'm very attached to the Mississippi River. But the exciting thing for me recently has been realizing that a lot of these small towns in the Driftless area that had been kind of disappearing, getting smaller, and some have disappeared. But you're starting to see little pockets of prosperity. Viroqua is the best example. I think of that as kind of the capital of the Driftless area. There are a number of businesses there that use the name, the Driftless Cafe, you know, Driftless Coffee, things like that. But Lanesboro, which we wrote about in the last issue, Lanesboro, Minnesota, is another one. And there's a culture rising. That's kind of exciting for me. And to go around and kind of see what's happening and try new restaurants. Try new beers. There's Driftless beer.
It's a rough job, but someone's got to do it.
I know. If I'm going to talk about it, I have to have experience.
That's right.
So, yeah.
We're talking with Reggie McLeod today, the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, and we're talking about the Mississippi River. So why don't you join in the conversation? All our lines are open right now, so why don't you give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, and you can always send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Reggie, of course, we've been hearing a lot about flooding in the Gulf area, but there also has been flooding in the Driftless area too, and July was kind of a bad month. Now, it seems like there's been more flooding in the area in the last few years. Do you think that that's the case, and do you think it's going to continue?
Oh, yeah, certainly. And we've been writing about that, not just in the new issue, which talks about the floods and the tornado in McGregor in July, but in the March-April issue, I talked to some weather experts and people involved with dredging the Mississippi River and so on. And the river's changing dramatically because of increasing rainfall. And just even the nature of the rainfall has changed. So I mean, of course, everyone's talking about the hurricane now. That's a big example. But that sort of thing is happening all around the world. It's part of climate change. But, for instance, last year was a record amount of rain in parts of Minnesota in the Twin Cities area. And we had this is the 10th anniversary of a flood we had here in Winona, where the magazine is. Places had 15, 16 inches of rain in just a few hours. And there were levees that were built to keep the water out from the Mississippi River, you know, to protect us from the Mississippi River and other bodies of water. And actually, the water came from the inland side and filled up to the tops of the levees. So they had to pump it out.
Yes,
and
I remember that.
Yeah, it was very bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that didn't really happen.
No. So what are communities doing to prepare for the possibility of this flooding?
Well, the thing that's kind of stuns me, actually, was years ago I worked for the Soil Conservation Service, and among other things, we designed structures that to protect about from flooding and to take into account different things. And we used tables based on the expected rainfalls, and they changed those tables in 2014. And it means that everything that was built before 2014, and the engineers used those tables to design roads, bridges, levees, things like that, they're out of spec now.
Oof.
They're really not designed to handle the current weather. And if the weather keeps changing in the future, they'll be even more out of spec in the future. So it basically means that all the infrastructure, it's kind of dramatic, infrastructure in the world built in the last few years can't handle the sorts of weather events that we're likely to see. And you see that very clearly in Texas now,
right.
Those photos of the flooded expressway corridors and so on. Those were built with tables that predicted the maximum rainfalls that would happen. And pretty much everything around us was built that way, and it's not up to spec.
So are there plans that you know of from some of the larger communities maybe to go with the new specs to improve what you have? It's got to be on their agenda.
Well, all the new things that are being built are built to the new specs, and they're going to start updating the specs more. I think the old ones had been put together in the 60s, and they weren't updated until 2014. And I think they have a plan now to update them every few years. However, if the weather keeps changing, if the rainfall amounts keep increasing, we'll
right.
always be playing
we'll always
catch-up
be playing
until
catch-up.
It stabilizes. So of course, the new stuff is going to be built better, and maybe they're going to start building in a little extra to account for change that's likely to occur in the future, because a lot of these features are used for, 50 or 100 years, They're long-term infrastructure, and they need to function the way they're built to function a certain way.
That's right. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network, and we're talking with Reggie McLeod. He's the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. What questions do you have about the Mississippi? What about the Driftless area? Give us a call. Our number, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Coming up at 11:45, we're going to be talking about the other side of Wisconsin. We're looking at an effort to restore Cat Island in Green Bay. Hope you can stay with us, but right now we're talking about the Mississippi and the Driftless area. And Reggie, we've got a couple of calls, so let's go to the phones. Kent in Galena, Illinois, you're up first.
Hi there.
Hi.
Excellent show. Enjoy listening, especially being in Galena, also one of
sure.
the Driftless areas. So I just wanted to point out that when you were talking about the name Driftless and the advent of its popularity, here in Galena we have a folk that alt band comprised of two young women, and it's called the Driftless Sisters, and an awesome group of people. And their parents are pickers, so they come from that whole river tradition of finding antiques and picking them and reselling them. So it's cool.
Wonderful. Well, thanks, Kent. Are there a lot of shops like that around the Driftless area, Reggie?
Well, there's there's a lot in Galena. That's kind of a where you should start if you're interested in that sort of thing. But yeah, there are in the small towns. And one thing, you know, some of these areas have had decreasing populations, and what that means is you end up having farm sales and house sales. And so a lot of antiques and kind of interesting things kind of get into the market that way. So there probably is a little more around here than in a lot of places.
Well, it brings in the people.
Yeah.
Let's go next to Bob in Richland Center. Hi, Bob. What do you have for us?
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Excellent program. We live in Richland Center. It's one of the most beautiful areas in the state. This fall, of course, around the 1st of October, the leaves will change again, and it would be a great drive for somebody that wanted to come through our town. The other thing that we have great trout streams, great hunting and fishing here. We have very curvy roads. When you talked about straight roads earlier, I was kind of laughing because we almost always see bikers come our way, during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
We have terrific apple orchards, as some people might know. And I recently, my wife and I traveled north of La Crosse and saw a number of apple orchards in that area. So that must be something. I think West La Crescent, Minnesota, has some apple orchards as well. So this might be a really great area for growing apples.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bob. We appreciate that call. Reggie, are there a lot of orchards in the area?
Yeah, that's a good point. There mm-hmm. are a lot of orchards. There's a lot of orchards around La Crescent, Minnesota, and Ettrick, Wisconsin. There's some down in Gaze Mills and Prairie du Chien. They're kind of all over the place. And the fall is the best time to go there because they have the biggest selection of apples, and they often have apple pie and other kind of special treats to draw people in. And it's a nice way to spend a day or two just kind of driving through the hills and looking at the colors and buying some apples. And of course, there are more wineries now, too, in the area.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And people often do that in the fall, too.
Yes.
Visit wineries.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. Thank you again, Bob. Next up, we have Linda in Madison. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I grew up in Richland County. I'm now living in Madison. And I've often heard the term coolie referred to the area. And I didn't know if that meant the entire Driftless area or just that part, you know, further west, Richland County, in the Minnesota part of the Driftless area.
Mm-hmm. Reggie, you did talk a little bit about that, didn't you? What does Coulee region mean?
Well, it's it's a term that's used more around the La Crosse region than when you get into Minnesota, and when you get very far from La Crosse, you stop hearing it. It's kind of a old French term for the small valleys that dot the region. And those, it's interesting that Bob mentioned the trout streams too. A lot of springs are up in the ends of these coulees, and they kind of start little trout streams that come together and make bigger trout streams. It's really a glorious place for trout fishing. I used to do a lot of trout fishing. The ticks have kind of changed some of my habits around.
You're not alone.
Tramping around in the woods, yeah.
Yeah, got to be careful. You know, we were speaking, thank you for the call, Linda. We were speaking of flooding earlier, and I was reading that story about the Bee Branch Creek in Dubuque. Mm-hmm. That was really interesting. Why don't you talk a little bit about that project and what they did there?
Well, and this is a trend that's going on all around the country. A lot of small streams were turned into storm sewers, basically, because it was kind of part of civilizing a place. You know?
Right.
You didn't want to have creeks out there.
No.
And, of course, this was, you know, when people were dumping things in creeks,
right,
too.
Right.
But now that's kind of reversing. And the Bee Branch Creek in Dubuque is has been a storm sewer for a long time, and it floods frequently. They've had, you know, a lot of bad floods. A few years ago, they had a flood right through downtown that was pushing cars all over the place and caused a lot of destruction. And so they had to give the water more room to get out of that valley just because of the increased rainfall. So they decided to what they call it daylighting a storm sewer, which means they turn it into a creek again, often along much of the same path that it was originally. And then they reserve enough land around it and control the slope and so on so that it can kind of serve as a reservoir for the water, because if you have a fast, heavy rain, it has to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they provide a green space for it to fill up, and then it drains out slowly, and then you have a lot of good recreational space in town then, too. So it kind of opens up the town. It has a bike path and gathering places and so on. And there are fish coming up into the B branch now, a lot of different fish species.
Really?
Mm. Yeah. So it's a really interesting process. And they've done that up in the Twin Cities for a couple big creeks, too. And it's starting to catch on. When I was a child in the 60s, I spent a lot of my time playing in creeks, and it was really sad to see a few of them got turned into storm sewers when I was a kid, and that was so sad to see. So it kind of, it's nice
that things are going back.
Yeah,
definitely. And I know most towns really need more green space because there just isn't much. So that's a great way to kill two birds with one stone, right?
Yeah, and they can actually use it to clean the water, too, and to kind of treat the water and let the dirt and things settle out of it. So with the B branch, the lower part of it, they actually have kind of a small lake reservoir where they have floating islands where the plants on the islands, the roots go into the water, and they can process out some of the nutrients that are in the water so that water is cleaner when it goes into the Mississippi River. So you're actually putting cleaner water in the river than you would if it was just a storm sewer.
Yeah.
And everything was going into the river, you know, the water bottles and the lawn fertilizer and so on.
All the stuff we don't want.
Yeah.
Well, let's
go
back to the phones, and we've got Jim in Menominee with something for us. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
You bet. What's up?
I've got a couple great opportunities for a fall trip down along the Mississippi, just south of La Crosse. There is a brand new Driftless Area Interpretive Visitor Center that just opened up just this month. It's in Lansing, Iowa, just south of La Crosse, just south of the Minnesota border. We visited there coming back from viewing the eclipse, and it's a nicely done center, some great exhibits. They explain about the Driftless Area. And as well, they have a lot of nice artifacts and displays about living along the river and the people and their occupations and jobs and living and working along the river. And that's brand new, just opened up. It's in Lansing, Iowa.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad you mentioned that, and I should have remembered to mention it if no one else did. I've been hearing a lot of good things about it, and Lansing is really kind of a hardcore, I don't mean hardcore in a bad way, I mean devoted river town. They had a clamming industry base there. They actually had a button factory that made buttons out of clam shells, and there's a lot of people, a large percentage of the people in that town spend a lot of time on the river, and they do a lot of work trying to take good care of it. There's a group called Friends of Pool 9 that includes Lansing and some of the other small towns around there, and they get out and clean the beaches and get out to support environmental opportunities and things like that. And a lot of those folks worked on this environmental center, and I'm looking forward to seeing it in the next couple of weeks because I've heard it's really a quality operation.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for telling us about it, Jim. We appreciate that. Let's go to Don in Eau Claire. Hi, Don. You had an interesting story to tell us.
Thank you for taking my call. I moved to Wisconsin in Eau Claire in 1953, and I've lived here ever since. I think it was in the probably in the 80s that there was a boulder that broke loose from up on one of the bluffs in the bluff area there, and landed on a house in Fountain City, and went through the ceiling of a bedroom. I kind of recollect that some person was killed at that time, but I heard afterwards that the boulder was left there, and it became sort of a tourist attraction. I was wondering if that was still the case. And then my second comment was that I'm sure that wasn't the first boulder that ever broke loose. That a good name for people in this area would be the Boulders.
Okay,
great.
Thanks,
or the
John.
Boulder Dodgers, maybe.
Yeah, there you go.
that's a fun roadside attraction. And I was on this show once about a year ago, and I misstated that I thought someone had died when that boulder came. It bounced right down the bluff side, went right through the roof of the house into the bedroom, hit the bed, and this one didn't kill anybody. That's happened in other places around here, and they have killed people, but they've kind of preserved the site, and for, I think it's a couple bucks, you can see the
boulder.
It's called the Rock in the House, which Wisconsinites will appreciate.
Sure, I've heard that. It's really near House on the Rock, right?
Yeah. And I went there once. Some friends were visiting from Madison, and they had a couple of teenage sons who were really seemed bored with everything, how that is. And we were driving by there, and I said, oh, let's stop and see the Rock in the House. And they took so many pictures. They thought that was so cool.
To each his own, right? That's why we got a variety of things to see.
But those big, beautiful rocks you see up on the bluffs are, every once in a while, one of them breaks loose and rolls down or bounces down. I mean, and they're almost as big as a house themselves, some of them, I mean.
Yeah. They're very large. Just real quick before we go back to the phones, I had read the little article that you had about the Asian carp and the efforts to stop them and where they've been seen. Can you kind of give us a little bit of an update on the carp?
A little update. Well, yeah. Well, you know, I grew up on the Great Lakes, even though I've been living on the Mississippi by the great majority of my life. I hate to see them getting into the Great Lakes, and the only way they can do that is through the artificial canals dug to connect the Great Lakes to the Mississippi River watershed. And they have electrical barriers that are supposed to stop them. I've always been a little skeptical about how effective those are going to be, and now they found a mature carp up above the barrier. And they're spreading in the whole Mississippi River watershed. They started in the they were brought over here. There are four varieties, and they were brought over here from Asia by people who are farming fish, largely. And they wanted them to eat snails and weeds and that and keep the ponds clean. And they brought them over with the guarantee that they would never escape. Of course, they escaped.
Yeah, famous last words.
Yeah,
right?
The ponds flooded and they escaped. And they're spreading up the river, too, farther and farther north. They actually closed the lock in Minneapolis to keep them from getting above there, because Minnesota has a lot of lakes and rivers up north that haven't been invaded by these carp yet. But they're most common in the Illinois River, in the lower Illinois River, and that's why they're kind of afraid of the Great Lakes, because that's a connection with Lake Michigan. It's through the Illinois River and those canals.
Yeah, and that would be a very bad thing, to say the least.
Yeah, they could spread very quickly if they get into the lake.
Right. Well, let's go back to the phones, and we've got Mike in Madison who's got a question for you. Hi, Mike.
Well, hi. Interesting show. I was just going to comment about the winding roads. I think that they're kind of, I'm familiar with the Kickapoo River area, and I think it's basically because the streams meander so much, and I think a name for the area people would be my recommendation would be meanderers.
Meanderers.
But it wouldn't cover the Mississippi River too much because those people are already referred to as river rats.
Yeah, that's true. But the river meanders a lot.
It does swing
back and forth a lot. And in fact, by Winona, it actually flows from west to east, which means when people come to Winona and ask directions, the locals never say, "Oh, go north or go south," because people always assume that the river is on the east side of town instead of the north. So you just never use those cardinal directions around here.
Good to know. Good to know. Okay. Well, thank you very much for the comment there, Mike. And let's go to Paul in Merrill. Paul.
Yes. Hello. This is the comment I was going to make, but off the last caller, I'd say Meandrethals.
Okay, I'm taking notes.
Yeah. Well, you may want to cross that one out.
No, I like
it. I like it.
Maybe we'll have to have a voters. my
question for you, Reggie, is do you remember a Driftless Area quarterly magazine called North Country Anvil that was based along the Zumbro River in Millville, Minnesota?
Actually, I was the editor of that magazine for 2 years when it was based in Winona.
Well, I guess you do then.
So I am familiar with it. And I see Jack Miller, the guy who started it and was editor for many years. I see him from time to time still.
Okay, well, thanks, Paul. And just for your notes there, Reggie, Doug from Trevor called to suggest people in the Driftless region be called Driftbillies. He says, I think they'd be proud of that.
I'll have to think about that one.
Yeah, I don't know if that's got real good connotations or not.
But I'm writing it down.
Write it down, you just never know, right? Yep. You know, we were talking a little bit about the Bee Creek there, or Bee Branch Creek in Dubuque, but another lake area that's been doing some like dredging, and there's a little bit of controversy around that, is Lake Pepin. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on there?
Well, that's ironic, and you can get complicated with it, but very simply, Wisconsin has a lot of sand in it, probably more than Minnesota, and the Chippewa River carries an enormous amount of sand into the Mississippi River, and that backs up the river and creates Lake Pepin. So you have that area that's almost 2 miles wide and that big lake because of the sand that builds up. But mm-hmm. the Army Corps of Engineers pretty much dredges sand out of there. It's not all sand. They call it dredge spoil, but mm-hmm. it's mostly sand. They dredge that pretty much constantly now during the warm months. And it's an enormous amount of work to keep the channel 9 feet deep there. It's right at a little place called Reed's Landing, which is just upriver of Wabasha and Alma, Wisconsin. And they don't have any place to put the sand. They keep moving it around here and there. And they recently proposed buying farms with eminent domain, perhaps, and burying them in 4 feet of sand just to have places to store the sand. And there are a couple big concerns about that. One is their estimates of the future don't take into account the fact that the amount of sand is probably going to increase. So they'll probably be increasing. They've been dredging more sand out of that area constantly. I think it's 20% more than they did 20 years ago. But they're not saying, they're doing a long-range plan, but they're not saying in 20 years we'll be dredging another 20% more sand. They're not saying that. So a lot of the local people around there are kind of skeptical of this plan, thinking, well, once they get this going, they'll say, oh, look, we have more sand. We'll just have to bury the farms under 6 foot of sand or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other concern, and this is a little touchy, because the only reason that the main reason that the lock and dam system is in the Mississippi River and that they have to maintain a 9 foot channel is to ship agricultural commodities down the river to New Orleans to be exported. So they mostly ship corn and soybeans, and virtually all of that gets exported. And so to lose farmland in order to keep the prices of the crops up is kind of a tricky situation.
Sure.
And it's a support of the farmers that keeps the lock and dam system operating with the 9-foot channel, but it's the farmers that are most angry with this proposal. And some of the cities like Alma is very concerned that they have a lot of trucks full of sand going through town. And the sand is all going to be transported around the area by trucks, like all the time.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a great situation.
No.
Yeah. Our guest that's coming up in a little bit is, they're talking about an effort to restore Cat Islands in Green Bay. And part of that is with the dredge spoil that you were talking about. So they created an island. Is there any thought about doing something like that?
Well, they do that in the river. And because of the lock and dam system and erosion and various other forces, a lot of the channels have filled in, a lot of the backwaters, and a lot of the islands have eroded away. So they do these big projects, and the Army Corps of Engineers oversees those, where they dig new channels and build new islands, and they've gotten very good at it. They've created some really nice wildlife areas in the backwaters now. Now, they're not creating them as fast as they're being lost, but they do use a lot of dredge spoils to build these islands. And so they're working on it to do a big project on the upper end of Lake Pepin, because that is filling in rather quickly. And they want to open up, dredge new channels, but also rebuild some of the islands that used to be there and kind of change the hydrology so that it will be better for boating and wildlife and so on into the future. So they do that, but that can't really use up all the sand.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for that segue into our next guest, Reggie.
Okay,
I appreciate
that. Yeah, good planning.
Yeah, and thank you so much for joining us once again. It's always, we learn so much when you're on, so we really appreciate you coming in.
Oh, I always enjoy it.
Thank you. We've been talking with Reggie McLeod. He's the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. And coming up next, we're going to be looking at that restoration project called Cat Island Restoration. It's near the port in Green Bay. Hope you can stay with us on the Ideas Network.